This program is intended for a print impaired audience. It is brought to you by Audio Journal. And thank you to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. Today we'll bring you news from the Spencer New Leader, and I'll be reading from the Friday, May 8th, 2026 edition. I'm Walter Bird with Audio Journal, and we read now from the Spencer New Leader, a publication of Stonebridge Press Newspapers, which is free by request to residents of East Brookfield, West Brookfield, North Brookfield, Brookfield, Leicester, and Spencer. Again, this is the Friday, May 8th, 2026 edition. Our first story, Leicester High School receives $3 million grant for HVAC and plumbing program. Out of Leicester, on April 30th, Governor Maura Healey, Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll, Education Secretary Stephen Zreike, and Department of Elementary and Secondary Education Commissioner Pedro Martinez announced a $3 million grant for Leicester High School to start HVACR and plumbing programs. Superintendent Brett Castigian said, quote, "I am surrounded by a strong team who created an outstanding grant application, and this will benefit our students for years to come," end quote. Leicester is one of only 28 schools in the Commonwealth to receive grant funding. Healey said, quote, "Across Massachusetts, we're hearing from students and families who want access to career technical education, or CTE. This investment will expand capacity, create new opportunities, and ensure more students gain the skills they need to succeed, while strengthening our workforce and supporting employers across the state," end quote. Leicester High has expanded offerings over the past 3 years to include 5 approved Chapter 74 programs and 2 innovation pathways. Only 4 years ago, there were no CTE offerings. This exponential growth is being noticed across the state. Zreike said, quote, "What Leicester is doing is impressive, and they are quickly establishing a reputation for innovation, serving as a model for others," end quote. On a local level, Donna McCants, chair of the Leicester School Committee, said, quote, "Investing in CTE not only prepares our students for higher learning potential in high-demand jobs, it provides a resource of skilled workers in our community. I am excited about the boost this will bring to our students and the economy. Dr. Castigian's passion and leadership keep the momentum going for growth in Leicester, and I'm proud to be part of it," end quote. Leicester High Principal Ted Zawada, Assistant Superintendent Rich Lind, and grant writer Neil Connery are all business, and collectively they said, quote, "The real work starts now, and this is no time to celebrate as we have much more to do," end quote. They are seeking volunteers to serve on the professional advisory councils for HVAC-R and plumbing. If you have expertise in either field and you are willing to help, reach out to the Leicester Public Schools. Principal Zawada also mentioned he will be seeking teachers in both fields. Zawada can be reached at zawadat@ipsma.net. That's zawadat@ipsma.net. One thing is for sure, there is much more to come, and the Leicester Public Schools promise to keep the school community informed. The next story this week, Jason Bull, correspondent, brings us Madbrook Road Bridge closing early. Blue writes, "The Madbrook Road Bridge in North Brookfield is closing effective immediately following an April 21st vote by the Board of Selectmen. The bridge was already slated for replacement, but was not expected to close until later this year. Selectmen read a letter from Barry Lorien, District 3 Highway Director for the Massachusetts Department of Transportation, or MassDOT, during their April 21st meeting requesting the bridge's immediate closure due to continued structural issues. Quote, "The good news is that design and funding are now in place so the town can move forward with the project and begin construction expected in summer of 2026. However, a recent inspection shows the bridge is continuing to deteriorate. The steel supporting the deck has weakened, raising safety concerns about keeping the bridge open," end quote, Lorien said. In March, Selectmen confirmed that state funding had been secured through MassDOT's Small Bridge Program to replace the structure. MassDOT helped design a replacement, and it was expected the current bridge would remain open to traffic until construction began. Those plans have changed following MassDOT's continued monitoring of the bridge's condition, necessitating an early closure as the department works with local highway officials and the town's project consultant on approving the bridge plans. Selectmen had no issues with the early closure, with Selectman Jamie Gelman acknowledging the bridge's condition is getting worse. Quote, "After looking at the trusses underneath the bridge, I understand a concern," end quote, he said. Selectmen voted unanimously to grant MassDOT's request and confirm the town already had the signage on hand to initiate the closure. The bridge is now confirmed closed until the replacement is complete. In March, the board confirmed they would be working with BSC Group as the engineering firm and that the building process or bidding process had yet to begin, with highway officials calling the big package complex. The April 21st meeting did not provide any major updates on that process. An end note in this story, in the New Leader's March 27th edition, a story announcing the grant funding for the bridge erroneously referred to the structure as Mud Brook Road instead of Mad Brook Road. We would like to apologize for this error and any confusion it may have caused. The next story in this week's Spencer New Leader, school district featured in Business View magazine for innovation and purpose-driven education. Out of Spencer, the Spencer East Brookfield Regional School District is proud to announce its selection as a featured cover story in the April 2026 issue of Business View magazine. The in-depth article, titled Purpose-Driven Education for a Changing World, highlights the district commitment to academic excellence, sustainable facilities, and innovative career pathways. The feature emphasizes the district's role as an innovative school district that is preparing students for life beyond the classroom through community partnerships, fiscal discipline, and specialized STEAM, early college, and CTE programs. Key highlights from the feature include infrastructure excellence, recognition of the major renovation and expansion of David Prouty High School, which includes state-of-the-art facilities like Lulam timber beams and energy-efficient insulated concrete form ICF wall systems. Award-winning sustainability, celebration of the district's status as a Green Ribbon Award nominee for its achievement in reducing environmental impact and improving health and wellness. Comprehensive student support, a focus on the district's Cubs Corner preschool program, a 2025 Resiliency Award recipient, and the elementary school's Purple Star Awards for supporting military-connected families. AI and future literacy, mention of the district's inclusion in Digital Promises League-leaning collaboratives to elevate AI literacy. Superintendent Paul Howie said, quote, "This recognition by Business View magazine is a testament to the hard work of our educators, students, and community. It showcases our strategic priorities of policy management, financial planning, and effective communication as we shape the future for our students," end quote. The full digital edition featuring the district is now available to the public on the Business View magazine website. For more information regarding the revised academic calendar, visit the district website. North Brookfield Fire Department celebrates 175 years. Correspondent Jason Blue writes out of North Brookfield, "The North Brookfield Fire Department has always been a treasured part of its local community. Founded in 1851, the department houses the legacies of friends, families, neighbors, and community leaders who all played a role in making the department an ever-growing part of North Brookfield's history. Even 175 years after its founding, the department is still growing and continues to be one of the town's most resilient and important assets to this day. Housed in a building constructed in 1878, albeit with a few new renovations, the North Brookfield Fire Department takes its history to heart, and that it even more apparent thanks to new additions to the building's main entryway, which were finally presented to the public during an annual open house at the town's May Festival on May 2nd. The department celebrated its 175th anniversary by welcoming guests to see the renovated facility, which now includes a tribute to the department's long history through an authentic uniform sweater and pieces of a cart that served as remnants of its early days. The cart is the only remaining piece of history from the department's beginnings in 1843, before it became an official entity in 1851. The day included tours of the building where visitors could learn about the department's past and present and provided an opportunity for members, both current and former, to reminisce on a long history of service that has kept the fire department going strong all this time. The importance of the day was not lost on Chief Keith Marshall, who is well-versed in the department's long connection to the community at large. Quote, "We've had members that have generations involved in this department. One of my predecessors was the second chief in his family. His father was the chief for a number of years before him. Just seeing the legacies go on through the town and how intertwined the town is, it's great," end quote, the chief said. Peter Orsi, a retired firefighter and current EMS director for North Brookfield, spoke about the many families whose histories are rooted in service with the fire department. Orsi said, quote, how many people in town have been a part of the fire department? How many families? There's a lot of history, a lot of neighbors who have been part of this, so it is pretty cool, end quote. During tours of the building, representatives of the department showcased the history still preserved within the walls of the existing structure that once housed horse-drawn carriages used during fire emergencies. Today, the department has an unattached garage that houses its modern apparatus. But through all the changes and evolutions, that small-town spirit has persevered. Events like the open house show the community still values the department's place, not only as an asset that protects and serves their neighbors, but one of the most resilient pieces of the town's storied history. One of the photos accompanying this story shows a display in the renovated entryway of the North Brookfield Fire Department and showcases pieces of the department's history. There's a picture on the front page that goes with this story showing the current facilities and how they blend the new and the old, maintaining a renovated building from the 1870s along with a newer garage for its apparatus. The New Leader has a correction in this week's issue. The New Leader would like to issue a correction and clarification to a story printed in the May 1st edition regarding the upcoming election in Spencer. Our story informed voters a question in the election would involve override funding to assess an additional $368,390 in real estate and personal property taxes for the purpose of funding four firefighters in the Spencer Fire Department for the fiscal year beginning July 1st. However, the story erroneously implied these were new positions being added to the department. This is false. These are not new positions. These are existing positions that are currently grant-funded and will require town funding to maintain them. These four firefighters are already part of the existing nine full-time employees of the department. With the grant funding set to expire, the town is seeking an override to fund them through the town budget. The election question seeks to secure those funds and keep the Spencer Fire Department at its current staffing levels, not to add brand new staff. The New Leader apologizes for any confusion or misconceptions this may have caused as voters prepare to head to the polls on May 12th. Well, next up, Lester Public Schools celebrates an annual evening with the arts. Out of Lester, on April 15th, the Lester Public Schools hosted its 28th annual evening with the arts, an event showcasing the arts and contributions of all students in grades K through 12. Lester Elementary art teacher Kristen Pike said, quote, the evening showcased a wide range of student work and performances in art, music, band, chorus, and drama, highlighting the important role the arts play in children's growth and development. Participation in the arts helps students build creativity, confidence, collaboration skills, and self-expression while strengthening their connection to the school community, end quote. And Pike added, quote, this year's event also featured a special collaboration with CARE, or CARE, Lester, an organization dedicated to protecting Mother Earth and encouraging the community to take pride in keeping Lester clean and beautiful. Through their Team Up to Clean Up initiative, CARE hopes to inspire and sustain efforts to care for the local community. An art display titled Art for Earth's Sake was created to help raise awareness about this meaningful organization, to highlight the importance of taking pride in and caring for our community, end quote. Middle school visual arts students added advocacy posters while practicing typeface skills. The performance arts were also highlighted throughout the event with performances from the Lester Elementary School Chorus, Middle School Maroon Band, High School Chorus, Middle School Concert Band, High School Concert Band, Middle School Symphonic Band, and Scenes from Annie by the Lester High School Drama Club. Coincidentally, the Lester High School and Middle School Bands chose the same piece to perform this spring, Scott Watson's Terracotta Warriors, inspired by the spirit army of 6,000 clay statues created for the tomb of the first emperor of China. This fascinating work opens with a brief plaintive folk chant that summons the warriors from their centuries-old sleep. Approximately 50 students in grades 6 through 12 combined to perform the piece together, which opened with a recorded solo by 7th grader Larissa LaFlamme. The piece also featured a unique percussion instrument, the marching machine, which was built by Lester resident and band parent David Hipple. Alyssa Hill said, quote, as the elementary music teacher, my favorite part of Evening with the Arts is watching the middle and high school performances. It is amazing to see how far students have come as musicians since their first musical experiences in kindergarten, end quote. Other students also enjoy seeing how far they have evolved throughout their school careers. Lester High School senior Abby Forrester said, quote, I love seeing all the artwork from the younger students. This is a fun experience to come together one final time for the drama club to perform as a family, end quote. Forrester played Miss Hannigan in this year's production of Annie. Alexis Phillips, who directed the high school band, chorus, and drama club, emphasizes the event showcases student accomplishment that cannot be shown through a test score or good grade. Success in the visual and performing arts takes time and resilience to accomplish. A new exhibit this year featured the ways in which art, music, and theater groups have been involved with community services and events. Some events included the LMS 9/11 Remembrance Concert, Christmas caroling at Lester's Historic Swan Tavern, musical performances at the Songus Arena and the DCU Center, participation in the Quabbin Valley Music Educators Association Junior Band, and using student artwork to celebrate or recognize various community members, to name just a few. Quote, involvement in the community of Lester and beyond is an important part of our programs. Our students are learning the value of the arts and the happiness it can bring to others when we share our talent and skills, end quote, middle school music teacher Christina Looney said. And Pike added, quote, the most rewarding part of our annual evening with the arts is watching students proudly stand behind their artwork and share it with their families and friends. Seeing their confidence grow and knowing they feel valued as artists is what education is all about. Next up, Lester High School students work toward OSHA 10 certification. At Lester High School, students in the Career and Technical Education, or CTE, division are taking a meaningful step toward their future careers by working to earn their OSHA 10 certification. Through a blend of self-paced modules and instructor-led training, students are gaining essential knowledge about workplace safety, which is an area that is critical across all industries. Under the direction of electrical instructor Jeffrey Romano, the program emphasizes both practical understanding and real-world application. Romano highlighted the value of the certification, noting, quote, students understand the importance of safety in the workplace. They are aware that employers are more likely to hire someone with OSHA 10 certification. To date, 55 CTE students have successfully completed the course, end quote. The OSHA 10 program is a requirement set by the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, ensuring all CTE students build a strong foundation in workplace safety practices. According to Career Technical Vocational Program Director William May, this training plays a vital role in student preparation. He said, quote, the OSHA 10 program is required by the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education and ensures all CTE students develop a strong foundation in workplace safety practices, end quote. Beyond meeting state requirements, the certification offers students a valuable credential that signals to prospective employers their readiness to maintain safe and compliant work environments. This advantage can make a significant difference as students enter the workforce or pursue further training. The CTE programs involved in the OSHA training include culinary, health assisting, building property maintenance, electrical, and early education care. Their achievement reflects both their commitment and the support of dedicated CTE educators like Mr. Romano, as well as Nina Ryan, Joe Richardson, Melissa Ledbetter, Andrew O'Coin, and James Burgess. West Brookfield Farmers Market returns Wednesday, June 3rd on the beautiful West Brookfield Common for its 16th consecutive season. The 2026 season market will feature 15 vendors with a wide array of locally grown and made goods, including three new vendors sure to please our customers. The West Brookfield Farmers Market is held every Wednesday afternoon, 3 to 6 p.m. on the West Brookfield Common, starting on June 3rd through October 7th, rain or shine. Featured vendors in 2026 include autumn leaf mushrooms, all sorts, eggs, microgreens, round table cheese, Bucher Brothers kombucha, Dragonfly Flower Farm, freshly grown flowers, Flourish Farms, organic vegetable and herb plants, microgreens, turmeric, and ginger root figs in season, Grimes Apiary Honey, honey sticks, bee pollen, hand cream, whipped honey, Hoffman Breads, artisanal breads, pastries, Jars Savory Pastries, pre-made foods, baking and soup mixes, Joy of Beans, fresh roasted coffee, whole bean or ground, specialty teas, Kate Bakes, sweet baked goods, Naltog Farm Maple Syrup, Nana's Kitchen, granola, granola bars, herb blends for the kitchen, Stillman Farm Fresh Produce, vegetable and fruits, Thompson's Maple Farm Ice Cream, roasted maple pecans, bourbon aged maple syrup, Crafts, Chairman of the Board, cutting boards, birdhouses, garden trellises, B&D Enterprises, turned wood products, beautiful salad forks, knives, and ink pens. Next up, Financial Focus column by Trevor Nielsen. This week's column titled, Four Estate Planning Myths That Could Cost You and Your Family. Nielsen writes, consider this scenario. A teacher of 30 years and mother of three passes away at the age of 58. She leaves behind a modest home, a retirement account, and cherished family heirlooms, but no estate plan. Her children, still grieving, find themselves navigating a confusing probate process, disagreeing about who sells the house and considering who gets their grandmother's ring. This mom wasn't wealthy by any measures, but her lack of planning created confusion, conflict, and uncertainty at a time when her family needed clarity. Her story reminds us of an important truth. Estate planning is about easing conflict and making sure what you have goes where you want it to go. As you think about your own legacy, consider these myths that can lead to costly mistakes and unintended outcomes. Myth 1. Estate planning is only for wealthy people. The desire to make things easier for loved ones has nothing to do with net worth. Formally documenting your wishes reduces the burden on family members and gives you control. Without a plan, your estate's laws will decide how your estate is handled, and you may not like what those laws say. Myth 2. Having a will is all you need. While a will is important, it only takes effect after death. That means it offers no protection if you become incapacitated and cannot make decisions for yourself. It does, however, allow you to name legal guardians for dependent children. The foundation of most estate plans includes a will, which directs asset distribution, a financial power of attorney for financial decisions, a health care power of attorney for medical decisions, and a medical directive to share your end-of-life wishes. While not everyone needs a trust, there are several that allow you to make special provisions, such as for minor children, a special needs family member, or even a cherished pet. Consulting with a financial advisor and an estate planning attorney can help determine the right combination based on your situation. Myth 3. Equal distribution is always fair. It's likely the individuals in your estate plan, especially if they are adult children, have different family and financial situations. You may have one child who's extremely successful financially while another is struggling. Or you may have assets, such as a house or ownership of a family business, that are more suitable for one beneficiary than another. It's important to consider any unique circumstances as you develop your estate plan. Myth 4. I can set it and forget it. You'll want to review your estate plan every few years or when a major life event occurs. Life is full of changes, such as marriages, divorces, new children, and relocations, and they will likely impact your goals. Reviewing your plan helps keep everything aligned with your wishes and serves as a reminder to keep your beneficiaries on all your assets up to date. Ultimately, estate planning is about helping to ensure your voice is heard and your loved one is cared for, no matter what the future holds. Our next column this week, Lanterns Along Main Street by Charles. This week's column titled The Quiet Way Our Mothers Shape Us. There's a certain quiet to a Sunday morning in May that feels different from the rest of the year. Maybe it's the way the light comes in softer, or the way people seem to move a little slower, a little more thoughtfully. Or maybe it's just we all know what the day is even before we say it out loud. Mother's Day has a way of doing that. It doesn't need much announcement. It settles in gently, like a familiar song you haven't heard in a while, but still remember every word, too. I was thinking the other day about how we tend to mark time in our lives. We remember the big things, of course. The graduations, the weddings, and the first jobs. But when you really sit with it, it's often the smaller, quieter moments that come back the clearest. And more often than not, there's a mother somewhere in the middle of those memories. Not always in the foreground, mind you. Sometimes she's just off to the side, making sure everything is running the way it should. Packing lunches, folding laundry, or reminding someone about an appointment, or standing in the doorway watching the whole thing unfold. It's funny how much of that work goes unnoticed at the time. Not unappreciated exactly, just assumed. Like the sun coming up in the morning. You don't always stop to think about it because it's always been there. I can remember years back coming home after a long day, the kind where nothing seems to go quite right. You're tired, maybe a little irritated with the world, and not particularly good company. And there she is, asking how your day went, as if she's got all the time in the world to listen to your answer. And she means it. That's the part that sticks with you. There's a steadiness to mothers that's hard to put into words. Not all of them are the same, of course. Some are quiet, some are talkative, some are firm, some are gentle. But there's usually a thread that runs through all of them, a kind of quiet determination to make things better for the people they care about. You don't always see it when you're young. In fact, I'd say most of us miss it entirely at the time. We're too busy growing up, figuring things out, making our own mistakes. It's only later, when life has had a chance to knock a few corners off us, that we start to understand what was really going on. I've come to believe that a lot of what we carry with us into adulthood, the good habits, the sense of right and wrong, the way we treat other people, has roots that go back to those early days. To kitchens and living rooms and car rides where lessons were taught without even feeling like lessons. And if you're lucky, those roots hold firm. Mother's Day, for all the cards and flowers and phone calls, isn't really about any of that, at least not entirely. Those things are nice and they matter, but they're more like symbols than anything else. What the day really does is give us a reason to pause, to notice, to think about the people who shaped us in ways we didn't always recognize at the time, to pick up the phone if we can, to say thank you, even if it feels a little overdue. And for those who can't make that call anymore, it's a day to remember, to sit with those memories and let them come as they are, sometimes warm, sometimes a little bittersweet. I don't think there's a right way to spend the day. Some folks gather with big family dinners, full tables, and loud conversations. Others keep it quiet, maybe a visit or a walk, maybe just a moment to themselves. But however it's spent, there's something steady about it, something that reminds us that no matter how much the world changes, some things remain constant. The care, the patience, the way someone showed up day after day, whether we noticed or not. You don't need a grand gesture to recognize that. Sometimes it's enough just to stop, look around and understand, maybe a little better than we did before, what was given to us along the way. And if you happen to find yourself on Main Street this weekend, passing by the shops and the familiar faces, you might notice something else too. A few more people carrying flowers, a few more smiles exchanged, a few more quiet moments tucked into an otherwise ordinary day. That's Mother's Day, I suppose. Not loud, not showy, just present, the way it's always been. And if you ask me, that feels about right. In Southbridge, a new spring exhibit celebrating color, renewal, and creative expression will open this month at the Ruth Wells Center for the Arts, featuring recent work by local painter and photographer Laura Senadella. Titled April Showers Bring May Flowers, the show runs from May 9th through May 24th with an opening reception that was held Saturday, May 9th. Senadella, a Brookfield-based artist, brings a wide-ranging body of work that reflects her background in both painting and photography. Working across oil, acrylic, watercolor, and pastel, she has built a reputation for vibrant, expressive pieces, as well as commissioned works, including murals and pet portraits. Her photography has also gained recognition, most recently appearing in the Small Stones 2026 art catalog. Her artistic path began in high school and has evolved into a largely self-directed practice. Over the years, her work has earned awards from organizations such as the Massachusetts Cultural Council, the Blackstone Valley Art Association, and the Massasoit Art Guild. She remains active in the regional arts community, serving as a board member of the Blackstone Valley Art Association and maintaining memberships with several arts organizations. Senadella's work has been displayed in venues across Massachusetts, including libraries and the Worcester Art Museum. And she continues to expand her reach through both in-person exhibitions and online following built through videos documenting her creative process. In addition to her studio work, Senadella has been involved in community outreach, leading art workshops in partnership with Open Sky Community Services in Whitensville, and teaching through adult education programs, including at Bay Path Technical High School. She has also participated in recent local exhibits at the Jacob Edwards Library in Southbridge, and the Charlton Public Library. The upcoming show marks her latest solo exhibition and continues her focus on making art accessible within the community. The opening reception will also feature live music by George Hamilton Smith, who will perform jazz standards on the gallery's grand piano. The gallery will open from noon to 4 p.m. on weekends, with weekday and evening visits available by appointment. To schedule a viewing, you can contact ruthwellsart@gmail.com or call 508-764-3341. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Walter Bird. Thank you for listening.
Welcome all to Audio Journal's Poets' Corner, the program that offers its print-impaired audience and other listeners the opportunity to listen to poetry of people from all walks of life, of those from the distant past right up to the present day. This production is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. I'm George Blomquist, and for the next half hour, I'll be presenting the poetry of the so-called Fireside Poets, the five famed mid-to-late 19th century American writers, essayists, and yes, poets, who became quite popular in both America and England during the course of the 19th century. They were Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Oliver Wendell Holmes, John Greenleaf Whittier, James Russell Lowell, and William Cullen Bryant. They were also called the schoolroom poets or the household poets because of their preference for conventional forms of rhyming and metrical cadences, which made their work popular for memorization and recitation in classrooms and homes on both sides of the Atlantic. Today, the fireside poet's verse may seem more Victorian in sensibility than romantic, perhaps overly sentimental or moralizing in tone. But, as a group, they are notable for their scholarship, political sensibilities, and the resilience of their lines and themes. Now, obviously, there's no way we can adequately give all five writers their just due in merely a half an hour. Consequently, I'll be reciting the poems of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and Oliver Wendell Holmes today, followed by the works of the remaining three, Whittier, Lowell, and Bryant, next week. So, without further ado, I'll now open our program with first a brief biological sketch of Longfellow, followed by several of his poems, beginning with The Wreck of the Hesperus. Longfellow was born on February 27, 1807, in what is now Portland, Maine, which was then still part of Massachusetts. He graduated from Bowdoin College and became a professor there, and later at Harvard College after studying in Europe. His first major poetry collections were Voices of the Night, published in 1839, and Ballads and Other Poems, published in 1841. He retired from teaching in 1854 to focus on his writing, and he lived the remainder of his life in the Revolutionary War headquarters of George Washington in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Longfellow wrote many lyrical poems known for their musicality, often presenting stories of mythology and legend. He became the most popular American poet of his day and had much success overseas. In fact, at the peak of his career, Longfellow's popularity in England rivaled that of her own Alfred Lord Tennyson, and he was the first American poet to be honored with a bust in Westminster Abbey's Poets' Corner in 1884. He died on March 24, 1882, in his beloved Cambridge, Massachusetts. And now, let's begin our program with one of Longfellow's more famous narrative poems, The Wreck of the Hesperus. It was the schooner Hesperus that sailed the wintry sea, and the skipper had taken his little daughter to bear him company. Blue were her eyes as the fairy flax, her cheeks like the dawn of day, and her bosom white as the hawthorn buds that ope in the month of May. The skipper, he stood beside the helm, his pipe was in his mouth, and he watched how the veering flaw did blow, the smoke now west, now south. Then up and spake an old sailor, had sailed the Spanish main, "I pray thee put into yonder port, for I fear a hurricane. Last night the moon had a golden ring, and to-night no moon we see." The skipper, he blew whiff from his pipe, and a scornful laugh laughed he. Colder and louder blew the wind, a gale from the northeast, and snow fell hissing on the brine, and the billows frothed like yeast. Down came the storm and smote amain the vessel in its strength. She shuddered and paused like a frigid steed, then leaped her cable's length. Come hither, my little daughter, and do not tremble so, for I can weather the roughest gale that ever the wind did blow." He wrapped her warm in his seaman's coat against the stinging blast, he cut a rope from a broken spar and bound her to the mast.
"Oh, father, I hear the church bells ring. Oh, say, what may it be?"
"'Tis a fog bell on a rock-bound coast." And he steered for the open sea.
"Oh, father, I hear the sound of guns. Oh, say, what may that be?"
"Some ship in distress that cannot live in such an angry sea."
"Oh, father, I see a gleaming light. Oh, say, what may it be?"
But the father answered never a word. A frozen corpse was he. Lashed to the helm, all stiff and stark, with his face turned to the skies, the lantern gleamed through the gleaming snow on his fixed and glassy eyes. Then the maiden clasped her hands and prayed that the saved she might be, and she thought of Christ, who stilled the wave on the lake of Galilee. And fast through the midnight dark and drear, through the whistling sleet and snow, like a sheeted ghost the vessel swept towards the reef of Norman's Woe. And ever the fitful gusts between, a sound came from the land. It was the sound of the trampling surf on the rocky and hard sea sand. The breakers were right beneath her bows. She drifted a dreary wreck, and a whooping billow swept the crew like icicles from her deck. She struck where the white and fleecy waves looked soft as carded wool, but the cruel rocks, they gored her side like the horns of an angry bull. Her rattling shrouds, all sheathed in ice, with the masts went by the board. Like a vessel of glass, she stove and sank. Ho, ho, the breakers roared. At daybreak, on the bleak sea beach, a fisherman stood aghast to see the form of a maiden fair lashed close to a drifting mast. The salt sea was frozen on her breast, the salt tears in her eyes, and he saw her hair, like the brown seaweed, on the billows fall and rise. Such was the wreck of the Hesperus in the midnight and the snow. Christ save us all from a death like this on the reef of Norman's Woe. About this poem, Wikipedia notes, Longfellow combined fact and fiction to create this poem. His inspiration was the great blizzard of 1839, which ravaged the northeast coast of the United States for 12 hours, starting January 6, 1839, destroying 20 ships with a loss of 40 lives. The poem appears to combine two events. Longfellow probably drew on the specifics of the destruction of the Favorite, a ship from Wiscasset, Maine, on the reef of Norman's Woe off the coast of Gloucester, Massachusetts. All aboard were lost, one a woman, who reportedly floated to shore dead, but still tied to the mast. The name used in the poem is that of another vessel lost near Boston. The poem is so well known that the loop road leading to Norman's Woe on Route 127 is named Hesperus Ave. In December 1839, Longfellow wrote in his diary about the writing of the wreck of the Hesperus, quote, "Suddenly it came into my mind to write, which I accordingly did. Then I went to bed, but could not sleep. New thoughts were running in my mind, and I got up to add them to the ballad. It was 3 by the clock. I then went to bed and fell asleep. I feel pleased with the ballad. It hardly cost me an effort. It did not come into my mind by lines, but by stanzas." On a much lighter note, here's Longfellow's delightful poem published in 1860, featuring his 3 beloved daughters, titled The Children's Hour. It reads, "Between the dark and the daylight, when the night is beginning to lower, comes a pause in the day's occupations. This is known as the children's hour. I hear in the chamber above me the patter of little feet, the sound of a door that is opened, and voices soft and sweet. From my study I see in the lamplight, descending the broad ball stair, grave Alice and laughing Allegra, and Edith with golden hair. A whisper, and then a silence. Yet I know by my merry eyes
They are plotting and planning together to take me by surprise. A sudden rush from the stairway, a sudden raid from the hall. By three doors left unguarded, they enter my castle wall. They climb up onto my turret, o'er the arms and the back of my chair. If I try to escape, they surround me. They seem to be everywhere. They almost devour me with kisses, their arms about me entwine, till I think of the Bishop of Bingen in his mouse tower on the Rhine. Do you think, O blue-eyed banditti, because you have scaled the wall, such an old mustache as I am is not a match for you all? I have you fast in my fortress, and I will not let you depart, but put you down into the dungeon, in the round tower of my heart, and there will I keep you forever, yes, forever and a day, till the wall shall crumble to ruin and moulder in dust away. Here's a gently poignant poem wherein Longfellow blurs the line between memory and the supernatural. It's titled Haunted Houses. It reads, "All houses wherein men have lived and died are haunted houses. Through the open doors the harmless phantoms on their errands glide, with feet that make no sounds upon the floors. We meet them at the doorway, on the stair, along the passages they come and go, impalpable impressions on the air, a sense of something moving to and fro. There are more guests at the table than the hosts invited. The illuminated hall is thronged with quiet, inoffensive ghosts, as silent as the pictures on the wall. The stranger at my fireside cannot see the forms I see, nor hear the sounds I hear. But he perceives what is, while unto me all that has been is visible and clear. We have no title deeds to house or lands. Owners and occupants of earlier dates, from graves forgotten, stretch their dusty hands and hold in mortmain still their old estates. The spirit world around this world of sense floats like an atmosphere, and everywhere wafts through these earthly mists of vapor dense a vital breath of more ethereal air. Our little lives are kept in equipoise by opposite attractions and desires, the struggle of the instinct that enjoys and the more noble instinct that aspires. These perturbations, this perpetual jar of earthly wants and aspirations high, come from the influence of an unseen star, an undiscovered planet in our sky. And as the moon from some dark gate of cloud throws o'er the sea a floating bridge of light, across whose trembling planks our fancies crowd into the realm of mystery and night. So from the world of spirits there descends a bridge of light connecting it with this, o'er whose unsteady floor that sways and bends wander our thoughts above the dark abyss." We now conclude our consideration of Longfellow with his contemplative poem about the awesome wonders of nature, titled Woods in Winter. It reads, "When winter winds are piercing chill, and through the hawthorn blows the gale, with solemn feet I tread the hill that overbrows the lonely vale. O'er the bare upland and away, through the long reach of desert woods, the embracing sunbeams chastely play and gladden these deep solitudes, where, twisted round the barren oak, the summer vine in beauty clung, and summer winds the stillness broke, the crystal icicle is hung, where from their frozen urns mute springs
pour out the river's gradual tide. Shrilly the skater's iron rings, and voices fill the woodland side. Alas, how changed from the fair scene, when birds sang out their mellow lay, and winds were soft, and woods were green, and the song ceased not with the day. But still, while music is abroad, pale desert woods within your crowd, and gathering winds in hoarse accord, amid the local reeds pipe loud. Chill airs and wintry winds, my ear has grown familiar with your song. I hear it in the opening year, I listen, and it cheers me long. Our next fireside poet is Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr. Here's a quick thumbnail sketch of his illustrious life from the editors of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Oliver Wendell Holmes was born on August 29, 1809, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was an American physician, poet, and humorist, notable for his medical research and teaching, and as the author of the Breakfast Table series of essays. Holmes studied law at Harvard University before deciding on a medical career, and following studies at Harvard and in Paris, he received his degree from Harvard in 1836. He practiced medicine for 10 years, taught anatomy for 2 years at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, and in 1847 he became professor of anatomy and physiology at Harvard. He was later made dean of the Harvard Medical School, a post he held until 1882. Holmes achieved his greatest fame, however, as a humorist and poet. He wrote much poetry and comic verse during his early school years, and he won the national acclaim with the publication of Old Ironsides in 1830, which aroused public sentiment against the destruction of the USS Constitution, an American fighting ship from the War of 1812. Beginning in 1857, he contributed his Breakfast Table papers to the Atlantic Monthly and subsequently published The Autocrat of the Breakfast Table in 1858, The Professor of the Breakfast Table in 1860, The Poet of the Breakfast Table in 1872, and Over the Teacups in 1891, written in conversational style and displaying Holmes' learning and wit. Holmes died on October 7, 1894, in his hometown of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, as you may have surmised, I will indeed be reciting Holmes' most famous poem, Old Ironsides. But first, here's some background on the poem. Old Ironsides was composed by Holmes as a tribute to the USS Constitution, an 18th-century American battleship which was on the verge of being decommissioned. The ship was given its nickname, Old Ironsides, during the War of 1812 after battling the HMS Guerrière, whose cannonballs purportedly bounced off the USS Constitution's sturdy wooden sides as if they were made of iron. Old Ironsides became one of Holmes's most famous known pieces after it was published in the Boston Daily Advertiser in September of 1830. Due to the poem's popularity, the ship was saved from decommissioning. It is currently the world's oldest commissioned ship still afloat. Here, then, is Old Ironsides by Oliver Wendell Holmes. Aye, tear her tattered ensign down, long has it waved on high, and many an eye has danced to see that banner in the sky. Beneath it rung the battle shout, and burst the cannon's roar. The meteor of the ocean air shall sweep the clouds no more. Her deck, once red with heroes' blood, where knelt the vanquished foe, when winds were hurrying o'er the flood, and waves were white below, no more shall feel the victor's tread, or know the conquered knee. The harpies of the shore shall pluck the eagle of the sea. Oh, better that her shattered hulk should sink beneath the wave,
her thunders shook the mighty deep, and there should be her grave. Nailed to the mast her holy flag, set every threadbare sail, and give her to the god of storms, the lightning and the gale. Next is a somewhat melancholy piece titled The Last Leaf. About this poem, the website poemofquotes.com notes, "The Last Leaf speaks about the last person alive of out of all his friends and family. It's narrated by a young man who sees an elderly fellow who looks sad, as if he no longer wants to live, prompting the young man's musings. It reads as follows. I saw him once before as he passed by the door, and again the pavement stones resound as he totters o'er the ground with his cane. They say that in his prime, ere the pruning knife of time cut him down, not a better man was found by the crier on his round through the town. But now he walks the streets and looks at all he meets, sad and wan, and he shakes his feeble head, that it seems as if he said, they are gone. The mossy marbles rest on the lips that he has pressed in their bloom, and the names he loved to hear have been carved for many a year on the tomb. My grandmama has said, poor lady, she is dead long ago, that he had a Roman nose, and his cheek was like a rose in the snow. But now his nose is thin, and it rests upon his chin like a staff, and a crook in his back, and a melancholy crack is his laugh. I know it is a sin for me to sit and grin at him here, but the old three-cornered hat, and the breeches, and all that are so queer. And if I should live to be the last leaf upon the tree in the spring, let them smile as I do now at the old forsaken bough where I cling." Our next poem is The Chambered Nautilus. About this poem, poemanalysis.com writes, "This poem was written in 1858 as the poet's reflection on the natural world and the idea of struggle, growth, and evolution, using the chambered nautilus, a type of sea creature, as a metaphor highlighting the strength one can gain through struggling and the message one can interpret from the nautilus's life. It reads as follows. This is the ship of pearl which, poets feign, sails the unshadowed main, the venturous bark that flings on the sweet summer wind its purpled wings, in gulfs enchanted, where the siren sings, and coral reefs lie bare, where the cold sea maids rise to sun their streaming hair. Its webs of living gauze no more unfurl, wrecked is the ship of pearl, and every chambered cell, where its dim dreaming life was wont to dwell, as the frail tenant shaped his growing shell, before thee lies revealed, its irised ceiling rent, its sunless crypt unsealed. Year after year beheld the silent toil that spread his lustrous coil. Still, as the spiral grew, he left the past year's dwelling for the new, stole with soft step its shining archway through, built up its idle door, stretched in his last found home, and knew the old no more. Thanks for the heavenly message brought by thee, child of the wandering sea, cast from her lap, forlorn. From thy dead lips a clearer note is born than ever Triton blew from his wreathed horn. While on mine ear it rings, through the deep caves of thought, I hear a voice that sings, build these stately mansions, O my soul, as the swift seasons roll. Leave thy low-vaulted past,
let each new temple, nobler than the last, shut thee from heaven with a dome more vast, till thought at length art free, leaving thine outgrown shell by life's unresting sea. And now we'll conclude our program today with Holmes's stirring poem, A Hymn of Peace, which was celebrating the end of the American Civil War. It reads, Angel of peace, thou hast wandered too long. Spread thy white wings to the sunshine of love. Come, while our voices are blended in song, fly to our ark like the storm-beaten dove. Fly to our ark on the wings of the dove. Speed o'er the far-sounding billows of song, crowned with thine olive-leaf garland of love. Angel of peace, thou hast waited too long. Joyous we meet on this altar of thine, mingling the gifts we have gathered for thee. Sweet with the odors of myrtle and pine, breeze of the prairie and breath of the sea, meadow and mountain and forest and sea. Sweet is the fragrance of myrtle and pine, sweeter the incense we offer to thee. Brothers once more round this altar of thine. Angels of Bethlehem, answer the strain. Hark, a new birth song is filling the sky. Loud as the storm wind that tumbles the main, bid the full breath of the organ reply. Let the sound tempest of voices reply. Roll its long surge like the earth-shaking main. Swell the vast song till it mounts to the sky. Angels of Bethlehem, echo the strain. You've been listening to Poets' Corner, a production of Audio Journal, proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you have any comments or suggestions for Poets' Corner, please let us know by calling us at 508-797-1117 or by emailing us at info@audiojournal.org or by mailing us at Audio Journal, 799 West Boylston Street, Worcester, Massachusetts, 01606. This program has been archived on our website, audiojournal.org, along with other Audio Journal programs. I'm George Blomquist, thanking you for listening. And now, stay tuned for other local programming brought to you by Audio Journal.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No. What's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week, including the Gardner News. You can hear the Gardner News every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Stay in touch with your community by tuning in to Audio Journal. The Gardner News, every Wednesday at 6 p.m.